legacy of public media for years to come. To learn more about making an impact through planned gifts, call 305-350-7977.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents, Monday edition. Joseph Cooper with you, along with Bonnie Berman. Well, today we visit with University of Maryland professor and author Gar Alperovitz. He served as legislative director in both the U.S. House and Senate, and his latest work is What Then Must We Do? Straight Talk About the Next American Revolution. He joins us from Washington, D.C. Welcome to you, Gar.
Thanks for having me on.
Hi, Professor. You say that we don't have an economic problem in the U.S., but then you go on to say that a quarter of our society is living in poverty. Would you explain what you mean?
Yes, it's an interesting paradox. This is the wealthiest economy in the history of the world. Even today, were we to divide up the economic output equally, every family of four would get just under $200,000. That's a very rich economy. We don't have an economic problem in any technical sense. We have a political problem managing the wealthiest economy in the history of the world. So the underlying economic capacity of this system is extraordinary. On the other hand, the political and institutional powers that are managing it are not able, it is clear, to realize the potential of the underlying economics.
So your point in the book seems to be the presidential and congressional elections don't meet as much as city councils and such. Is that correct?
Well, if you could look at it this way. Remember, I at one point managed House and Senate staffs and so have been deeply involved in traditional political development. But if you look at the long, long trends of what's happening in the economy, it's clear that these kinds of decision-making processes, the things we are talking about all the time in the news and on television and radio, newspapers, what's happening in Congress, the fight with the Republicans, Tea Party, they're kind of secondary when you look at long 30-year trends that keep going on no matter what happens in terms of these. So, for instance, if you look at who got the income produced by this wonderful economic system, over 30 years, the top 1% has gotten just about all of the economic increase over 30 years. 30 years ago, they had about 10% of the income. This is the top 1%. And now they have about 20 or 21, 22, depends which year you measure it, irrespective of what's going on in the political sphere of who gets elected and all the things we see in the newspaper. So it's a very odd paradox that tells you that something far deeper is at work than what we normally focus on. It's a systemic problem that's generating deep, deep trends. I could give you many more, but that's the most obvious.
What do you mean by systemic?
Well, the way in which the corporate-dominated American political system, and I think it is corporate-dominated, we could get into the political science studies of that and talk about it, manages affairs seems increasingly to generate outcomes of that kind, the changing distribution to the top groups. You know, another statistic just to get to kind of symbolize all this or capture it. The top 400 individuals, 400 people, you could get them into a reasonable size small auditorium, have more wealth these days than the bottom 180 million Americans taken together. These are really dramatic illustrations of what more and more people are calling a systemic crisis. It isn't just the liberals and the left. It's the leaders of Davos asked the question recently, that where all the major corporations and banking leaders globally come together. Are we facing a profound crisis of the capitalist system? And I think that's the question that's being posed. Indeed, I'm speaking later at a large conference of experts from the business schools on corporate issues, and they're having a big conference in Orlando this summer focused entirely on that question. Is the problem much deeper than we're talking about? Are we facing something really fundamental at the core of American capitalism?
So then you ask us to answer the question to ourselves, if not corporate capitalism or state socialism, what do we want? But is that realistic to think we can have a radical, fundamental, systemic change?
Well, I wear two hats. One is as a political economist, and one as a historian. Obviously, systemic change is very, very difficult. But the truth is, it happens all the time in history. That is, very large systems get changed, but usually with a long, long buildup of time, and not always violently. We can think about the French Revolution on the one hand. You can think about the collapse of the Soviet Union, the collapse of apartheid, the American Revolution itself. All of these occurred in the face of predictions that certainly nothing could ever change. But there also have been other kinds of really revolutionary changes. Think about feminism in America in the 1940s. Women were really subject largely to male domination. They couldn't often get checking accounts or buy cars or houses on their own. They certainly didn't get into the job market. There's been a cultural revolution there that took many, many years, not yet complete, hopefully will be furthered. There's been a revolution in the Middle East, explosive revolution. So over time, I think that it is fair to say that great transformations in systems, and throw three decades on the table if you like, do happen. And it would be surprising if what you see in the United States today is the end of everything, that nothing ever got beyond this. So I'm very cautiously open-minded on whether any system lasts forever, and I'm very doubtful that the current one that we live with is either the end of history. And moreover, it's making a lot of people unhappy. I mean, the poll data are very, very clear that people are do not believe in the political system. They're very angry at the corporations, even more angry at the banks. So even while the system persists, the pain levels are growing. And the political kind of all the polling tell you something's going on that makes people very upset. Now, it isn't crystallized yet. And the way to think about this kind of a process, of course, is, the 20 or 30 years before the New Deal came in. At the local level and the state level, you saw all sorts of interesting experiments that were being developed in the, quote, laboratories of democracy, unquote, small experiments which later, when the time was right, became the basis of the intellectual DNA of much larger things at the national level. And I think that process is underway here and possibly may inform a transformation. I'm not an inevitabilist. It's just possible that things will go on as they are, that we will decay, that nothing will change. But I also think it's not inevitable that it won't be a large transformation given all the problems they're building up. I think we need to be open-minded about it.
Then why did the Occupy Wall Street didn't seem to really resonate in a widespread basis?
Well, the Occupy events are, they're beginning to be studied by the scholars, and they're very interesting in that there was an explosive moment, which is very typical of the prehistory of much larger change. And I think that's the word to look at, thinking about the next couple decades of prehistory and explosion.
You talk about bottoms-up events.
Things coming from the bottom up were unexpectedly. Telling you what the Occupy explosion tells you is that a lot of younger people really are fed up and don't know what to do. It's not surprising that you get explosions that in some ways are irrational, some ways not.
Is explosion really the right word?
Explosion of social activity, I suppose, would be a better formulation. Lots of people getting out and trying to do something to make their point in an unusual way. But, these are very early kinds of signs that if you look at these things historically in other countries, these are very early kinds of signs that something's wrong. It's kind of like the canary in the coal mine. You pay attention when something like that happens because it may symbolize something far, far more resonant. So I don't. The interesting thing about the Occupy movement, it was also magnified by the American press and television and radio to an extent, and then its disappearance was magnified as well. It disappeared from the front page of the newspapers. I've been traveling around the country, talking about this book, What Then Must Be Done, and what I've found, and it was kind of a surprise to me, is that the Occupy events served a particular function. They pulled large numbers of young people out of isolation, and they got them into some kind of activism, which was quite new for them. They've learned that they had political concerns, and they learned that other people did. And secondly, they made friends with other people at these Occupy sites. And if you go around the country, you'll find small groups, three or four people who met them each other in this way, who are beginning to try to do different things in their local community. So, for instance, a lot of people are trying to set up co-ops and worker-owned co-ops and changing who gets to own wealth, democratizing ownership. And other people are very much into changing the food system, and still others working on energy problems, many of whom met each other by this odd occasion that exploded into the press and then disappeared from the press, but maybe didn't disappear from these people's actual day-to-day experience in different ways. Occupy is only one piece of what's going on, but in the book, What Then Must We Do, I kind of survey really hundreds, thousands of changes at the grassroots level, all of which are characterized by changing who owns wealth, not the 1% having more than, or 400 people having more wealth than the bottom 180 million. An alternative system might transform this and democratize it. So, for instance, most people don't know that 130 million Americans are members of co-ops, which is a one-person, one-vote, garden-variety, mundane illustration of a more democratic ownership possibility. And that's just one. There are 11 million people, which the press very rarely covers any of this, 11 million people in worker-owned companies in the United States, 3 million more than exist in unions in the private sector. So if you go step by step, and to the extent we have time, I write about this in What Then Must We Do, there is something going on at the grassroots level and at the state level that the press doesn't have either interest in, and certainly that, the press is in very severe straits. Very few local reporters doing the reporting. You have to do different, really intense research of the kind that we've been doing at the university to find out what's going on, because the press doesn't cover it. There is a huge development in many, many different forms, all of which have this characteristic, and I think this is significant, of democratic ownership of one kind or another, like co-ops and worker-owned firms, but many, many more examples, building up in the face of a society in which ownership is so highly concentrated, really almost medieval in its concentrations.
Professor, we need to take a break. We're speaking with Gar Alperovitz. He's a historian, activist, and writer, professor of political economy at the University of Maryland, co-founder of the Democracy Collaborative. What Then Must We Do is the name of the book. We're going to come back and get some more specific examples of what we're talking about on Topical Currents. Stay with us.
And you're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and 91.5 WKWM, NPR for the Florida Keys.
This year, add to your legacy of great Mother's Day gifts by sending her flowers through WLRN.
She'll love the fresh bouquet of mixed flowers tastefully arranged by Field of Flowers, and she'll think you're pretty smart for supporting public radio at the same time.
To order, make a $120 contribution at WLRNradio.org or call 1-866-247-9576.
By investing in affordable summer camps and aftercare programs for over 16,000 children yearly, the Children's Services Council of Broward County helps engage youth in positive social and academic programs. Details at CSCBroward.org. The Children's Services Council of Broward County. Our focus is our children.
You can find Topical Currents on Facebook, a dedicated page with daily program descriptions, links to our guests, authors, and books. Facebook.com/topicalcurrents.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Professor Gar Alperovitz. The name of his book is What Then Must We Do? Professor, you talk about that the political system is really more stalemated today than in other periods of history, but I go back to Roosevelt wanting to expand the Supreme Court because he didn't get his way. Wilson was unable to get the League of Nations going. Truman complained about the Do-Nothing Congress, so Are we really in a historical era?
I think we are. And the reason is that on virtually all those fronts, the internal distribution of income did not significantly decay. That's what's really new. There was, you know, a boom period after the post-war boom, and World War II was an economic full employment society. And there's a whole time period that most people take as the norm, really from World War II on till the early 1970s. And income rose, and the distribution of income was either stable or positive, increasingly positive. That whole era was, I think, in many ways an aberration. And the capacity of the political system to impact things, which it did do during the New Deal, and which to in very significant ways, Social Security, labor law, organization, and ultimately, although he didn't get an increase of the Supreme Court, he did get through the agricultural laws that the court was opposing. They essentially backed down, even though he didn't get an expansion of the courts, Roosevelt. Many, many things occurred in that period. That's really over in some fundamental ways because you see these large trends in which, you know, the indicators that really matter to people, what's going on in the economy, are getting worse. We're in a period of basically stagnation with, we have a minor blip 1 month or the last 2 months, and then we get another decay with millions of people, doubled in number, normally unemployed, already unemployed, with millions of students coming out of college can't find jobs and are burdened down with vast loans. There is something going on in the system today that I think is best described as long-term stalemate and the decay. Yes, it's true that in the past presidents have been stymied on certain things, but when you actually look to, you know, the bottom line indicators, who's got what's going on employment, wealth, poverty, etc., those indicators are the big ones that tell you what's going on in the system. And whether the presidents get what they want or not on different days of the week is, although played up by the press, it's quite secondary to what people actually experience in everyday life.
If you'd like to join in the conversation, we're speaking with Professor Gar Alperovitz, and the name of the book is Then What Then Must We Do? Straight Talk About the Next American Revolution. The number is 1-800-743-9576. That's 1-800-743-9576, or you can email radio@wlrn.org. radio@wlrn.org. Okay, Professor, so let's look at some of these community building initiatives which you speak of in your book. Let's begin with the co-ops and worker-owned companies. Where are they specifically?
Well, there's a combination of things that are out there on the co-ops and worker-owned companies. First, there are historic co-ops and worker-owned companies, like the agricultural co-ops being an example, and the garden variety credit union, which is a one-person, one-vote bank. Those existed, and they are being kind of revitalized. I said 130 million Americans are members of such entities, a significant number of credit unions. But within the credit unions, for instance, which are in many cases rather mundane organizations, they're one person, one vote. Nobody goes to the annual meeting. Younger people are beginning to organize to elect their members to the boards of these banks. They have more capital, by the way, than any one of the big five banks in New York taken together.
The credit unions, Dan.
Credit unions, yeah. And that's the kind of, you know, the word revolution brings to mind explosions, but much more interesting is how institutions change over time, evolve. And take a look at the credit unions, what's going on there is one piece. Another piece, as I mentioned, is worker-owned companies. And they've been, there's an old form, which is called the employee stock ownership form, which has been around since the 70s, and that's been expanding slowly and steadily. And some of them are great, some of them are not so good. There's a lot of development to internally produce more democratic processes. And then there are a whole range of new co-ops being developed, mainly by younger people, both urban and rural worker-owned co-ops. So that's a whole other development that's appearing. You know, a lot of this is being driven now, the new changes, as you might expect, because of economic and social pain. People aren't doing this just because it's fun. They're creating these kinds of ventures really because there are no alternatives for jobs or services in some areas. And they're getting rather sophisticated about it. In What Then Must We Do, I describe, for instance, how 30 years ago, there was an attempt by steelworkers in Ohio to set up a worker-owned company when their big company, Youngstown Sheet and Tube in Youngstown, was shut down, which got a lot of support from the religious community and national community and got a lot of publicity, and ultimately got support from the Carter administration, which disappeared at a certain moment. But if you look at a 30-year path, and that's really the way to think about an evolutionary revolution, maybe, is in Ohio there are now lots more worker-owned companies that were stimulated by that explosion of in 1977. They workers in Youngstown didn't win, but in some sense they won the war, and if you look around Ohio, because their idea is in place without much publicity. There's a little institute at Kent State University that helps set these up, so there's more expertise. And more recently, in the city of Cleveland, there are innovative advances. And again, the press simply hasn't been covering this. You have to really dig. For instance, there's a complex of worker-owned companies in a very poor neighborhood there. Large scale, the large industrial scale, very green, ecologically green, industrial scale laundry to service nursing homes and hospitals. There is a solar installation company, worker-owned, which does both solar installation, and during the winter it does insulation rather than installation. And there is, just set up and opened up a couple months ago, the largest urban greenhouse in the United States, a multi-stakeholder cooperative.
But haven't Ohio's electoral votes this century all gone to Republicans?
No, indeed, no. We would not have the current president
no.
if they all...
Well, okay, last time, but in 2008 it did.
2008, I think it went the other way, is my recollection, and that's how we got our president. No. I may be wrong. I think you're right on that.
Yeah.
But Ohio has gone back and forth, but the president did win Ohio this year.
Right.
Past year.
You cite the press. You've cited the press a lot of times in our brief conversation for lack of interest in coverage of these grassroots movements in many states. Why is that? Why do you call it the decaying American press?
I didn't mean to say there's lack of interest. There may well be great interest, but... you know, the newspaper world is in great decay generally. That is to say, newspapers are losing money all over the country.
Right.
As advertising has moved to the internet and to television. And in the face of loss of revenues, I sympathize with the press. I'm not a critic in this respect. They have been essentially laying off reporters who, what are called beat reporters, who actually cover on the ground things in local communities. They just can't afford to do it. So it's not surprising that most people don't know about the kinds of things that we're talking about in this discussion. The press doesn't have it isn't its primary, you know, local things like this are not the primary interest in any case, but they simply don't have the manpower and women power to actually go out and dig and find out what's going on because they're losing money. It's a sad state. The press is in a very sad state, particularly the kind of local newspaper press.
Right.
I do want to mention something more about this Cleveland model because it's being followed in many other cities. It's a very, and the point here is not simply about these very interesting large-scale co-ops and worker-owned companies. The point of it is the growing sophistication from little co-ops. And this group is linked together with a revolving fund so that some of their profits go into a fund to create more of these large-scale worker-owned, very sophisticated entities like this big greenhouse. The greenhouse, by the way, it's not a little thing. It produces 3 million heads of lettuce a year. It's very large scale and very sophisticated, and so are the other parts of this.
And who do they service, this greenhouse?
It services the greenhouse in general supplies to that part of Ohio, but that's the other interesting feature, and again, the thing to watch is over time, increasing sophistication. In that very neighborhood, it's a very poor neighborhood of, 40% unemployment and 18,000 family income, largely black.
40% unemployment?
40% unemployment. It's very severe in that area. There exists in that neighborhood, and this is true in many parts of the country, large-scale, what are called anchor institutions that are sort of anchored. They can't leave, universities and hospitals primarily. And in general, and this is in this particular neighborhood, they buy $3 billion with a B dollars in goods and services a year, plus that's leaving aside their construction and leaving aside their salaries and wages. And they haven't been buying from this poor neighborhood. And the reason is there's been no capacity, of course. But they're beginning to shift some of their purchasing power to help rebuild these institutions. And worker-owned companies don't leave, like some corporations often come in and then leave after they get tax break. Worker-owned companies are people living there. So the whole development is to rebuild neighborhoods and communities, in part using the purchasing power of these large hospitals and universities, anchor institutions. And many, many cities are kind of copying this Cleveland model as well. So you're beginning to see the sophistication and spread of these kinds of innovative strategies. And again, I cover it in much more detail, obviously, in the book, and What Then Must We Do, than we can do briefly. But again, you need to probe down and find out what's going on in these very painful and difficult communities to see this process at work, laying down new ideas and new experiences that are very suggestive of where we might go in the longer-term future.
We're speaking with Professor Gar Alperovitz. The name of the book is What Then Must We Do? Straight Talk About the Next American Revolution. On today's Topical Currents, we have emails, we have calls, and we'll get to them after this break.
This is Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and NPR for the Florida Keys, 91.5 WKWM. Thanks for joining us today. City Year Miami unites a diverse group of 17 to 24-year-olds for a year of service as tutors, mentors, and role models who make a difference to students and schools. You can learn more online at cityyear.org. City Year, give a year, change the world.
War Horse is a heartwarming tale of loyalty and friendship. Winner of 5 2011 Tony Awards, this epic tale is both a highly inventive spectacle and a powerful drama. Theatrical magic, says the New York Times, moving and unforgettable. Time magazine calls it a landmark theater event. Live on stage, War Horse at the Broward Center May 7th through the 19th. Tickets at 954-462-0222 or browardcenter.org.
The U.S. economy is swooning while the Latin American economy is booming. That growing prosperity is giving Latin American leaders the confidence and clout to challenge decades of U.S. influence. I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Tim Padgett. Join us tonight at 7 for the Sunshine Economy, the Americas and Miami. More money than ever is flowing between the U.S. and Latin America. Miami is the economic and cultural link, but we face new competition.
From drug policy to business with China, the Sunshine Economy, the Americas and Miami. At 7 tonight on WLRN, made possible by Kaufman Rossin & Company.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman, we resume our conversation with University of Maryland professor and author Gar Alperovitz. Let's take a call or two, Professor. First up, we have John in Miami. Hi.
Hi, good afternoon. Good afternoon, Professor. My question is in reference to the transition that may or may not occur from capitalism within this country. I wanted to find out, based on what you know, do you see it as a smooth transition? Do you see it as not smooth? And to follow up on that, sometimes I feel that, you know, like you said, even people who are very poor in this country, they still live in the general relatively well as far as, you know, basic living. Do you feel that corporations almost, you know, we as a society subconsciously, we know that, so people don't want to still do something that would be rash or would be significant because it's not in their best interest? I wanted to get your opinion on that.
Well, the term revolution is an odd term. That is to say, the main point about the term is that very big institutions are changed. And people have in mind, the walls fall down and violence occurs. And that's probably the least form of revolution, though it certainly occurs and gets a lot of press. Take, for instance, the 19th century American economy. It started out mostly and almost entirely tiny, tiny, tiny small businesses, you know, very small businesses, and one person, one farm, small farms. That was the economic system. I'm exaggerating only slightly. By the end of the 19th century, the system was dominated by big banks and big corporations, and they had political clout. There was a total revolution in the nature of the system, though of course it wasn't violent. That's a transformation. So it's important to think about these things in terms of what are the institutional shifts that may or may not occur.
But, but the political clout of the corporations and the banks, they obviously wouldn't, it wouldn't be in their best interest to have any significant change. So how would people at a more grassroots effort, like you mentioned the Occupy movement, and you know, I feel that there was momentum there. Granted, it was a big house of different ideas, and there was no real consensus of ideology, but it was in the best interest of the powers to for lack of a better word, to crush that with media complicity.
Well, I don't disagree in the general broad terms of what you're saying, but I wanted to clarify what I meant by revolution. It is possible some revolutions may end in violence, and that's certainly a possibility. But I wanted to stress that the key issue is whether or not institutions are shifted. So let me just suggest to you another way of thinking about that. First, anger at the big banks was intense. The Obama administration gave them perhaps the least difficult response. They were totally, he met with 13 leading bankers, and when he told them what he was planning to do, which was the legislation that was passed, the Frank Dodd bill or the Dodd-Frank bill, they walked out of the room kind of joyous because it was a very modest attempt to curb their power and one that they now have shown that they can dominate in the lobbying process to get what they want. So very little happened. On the other hand, most experts left, right, and center predict further financial crises, and there is, the poll data is very clear. There's extreme anger at these big banks, including not only the liberals and left and young students, but the Tea Party was even more intense in its hatred of the big banks. I think we're going to see more crises at that level. We've been talking about local things, but at the other level, and we need to talk about many different levels, I think there is a process at work which is going to really target these big banks when they get in trouble again. They're more concentrated now than they were before the crisis. They've gotten more power, and they're more dangerous now in terms of financial explosions than they were. I think at some point, you know, there's legislation introduced by Senator Brown, of Sherrod Brown of Ohio, to break them up. And at some point, I think the anger is likely to be high enough that they will be broken up. I also think they will regroup, like AT&T and Standard Oil did, and get back doing the same things. And down the line, I think there are two processes at work. At some point, they may be nationalized. They were essentially nationalized briefly. The government took over more stock in a couple of them than it was the dominant shareholder. At some point, they may be turned into public utilities. Alternatively, and here's the grassroots side of this, many, many states are now building interest in publicly owned state banks, like the Bank of North Dakota, which, again, most people don't know about. Bank of North Dakota is owned by the state. If you like, it's a socialist bank, but it is very popular by the farmers and business people of that state. It operates just like a public utility, and 20 different states are considering legislation to set up public banks in their own states. So I think, and we talked earlier about the credit unions, which taken together are larger than any one of the New York banks, the Big Five. So there's another process at work, both the crisis level developments in the banking system, and remember, we're talking about the next couple decades, crisis developments that are likely, most experts think, in the big banks. But meanwhile, there's this other process at the laboratories of democracy, they used to say before the New Deal, of development of credit unions and public banks and state banks and city governments moving their money to banks that will help the community. There are two different processes at work. Some part of that, and this book is not, What Then Must We Do, is not an inevitabilist book. It suggests that some of these processes at work may well form the basis of ultimately a political part of the political movement when it joins forces with politics to begin transforming institutions. And that's the real question of transformative revolutions, whether the institutions shift in these various cases, city banks, credit unions, state banks, maybe even public utilities turning the big banks. What you're talking about is democratic control of these institutions over time.
Let's talk about the healthcare system. You must have been in favor of the passage of the Affordable Care Act, but is that enough? And what are they doing in Vermont?
I was reluctantly in favor of the Obama, you know, the CARE Act, yes, I would be a supporter, but only reluctantly because better alternatives were rejected. Well, the Obama health care plan was essentially a deal, as everyone who studied it, was quite explicit, with the big insurance companies. If they didn't cause too much opposition to the bill, then they would get 30 million new customers who were required to buy their insurance. And plus, then the other addition was some additional funding for very low-income people. And that's the structure. The insurance companies still control most of the action, and they've got new customers. That's a jerry-rigged system at best, and it's beginning to show many of the problems. It does include 30 million new people, and that's why you could support it, because it helps people who are in very, very severe straits. But a single-payer system would have been far more efficient. I mean, most people, I think, are aware that we pay virtually twice as much percentage of our economy for health care as most other advanced systems, 18% currently. Many systems are at 9% of the economy. And our health outcomes, the results, are the worst in the advanced industrial world by far. It's a terrible system by international comparison. Let me translate those percentages. That's about $1 trillion with a T more that is wasted when you look at what share of the economy other countries are using for health care with worse outcomes. That system is still in trouble. And I think what you're going to see as the pain hits many, many states, and here's where Vermont comes in, people, the corporations are going to start kicking people off, or companies are going to go up to 49 people and then set up another little company so they don't have the 50-person requirement to buy insurance,
right,
et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The pain levels, I think, are going to increase. And as that occurs, I think it's going to hit the state levels. And here's another part of the democratizing process. Vermont, but also other states, is just about ready to set up single-payer health care. California passed it twice, and it was vetoed by Schwarzenegger. Connecticut's online to do this over the next few years. 20 states have introduced legislation. And again, this larger process of democratic ownership, because of the failure and difficulties, we talked a bit about the banking considerations that are going on in the states. And again, the press doesn't cover this, as we said. It just doesn't have the manpower and woman power. If you look at what's happening on the ground with health care, I think there is all but certain to be a single-payer revolution state by state by state as the difficulties occur. And again, we're talking about the coming decades, not tomorrow's legislation. The reason being that the people are in trouble, they're in pain, and not getting answers out of the system, even as the tax costs and the costs of these things keep going up and up and up.
We have an emailer. I'm in complete shock that someone educated is finally coming out and admitting that the system is clearly not working for the masses, but is instead an opportunity-based feudal system that will and always work for the rich in the world. Hearing that someone's at least trying gives me new inspiration to keep trying. Thank you.
Well, thank you for listening. You know, what really got me, and I've been interested in these questions for, as I said, I worked on the Capitol Hill for both the House and Senate and did policy planning at the State Department for UN matters. But what struck me was going around the country and seeing that people are actually doing so many different things that have this characteristic of changing and democratizing ownership. And again, you know, I wear this historian's hat. If you're interested in really large-scale change, the last place to look is at the national election. That's what it comes last. What's really interesting is whether at the localities and the states something is building up. On the one hand, anger and sentiment, and on the other, really practical, very practical experiments. We've talked about the neighborhood level and co-ops and worker-owned companies, and we could talk about city-owned land trust and public utilities, you know, more electricity. 25% of our electricity is done by publicly owned utilities and co-ops. But it's happening quietly at the local neighborhood level, the workplace, the state level. And I think there are some, you know, some big things going on. We're talking about the national banking system and the healthcare system, which are big parts of the national economy, which I think are, over the next decade, are in real trouble because they're so badly organized. They're jerry-rigged and very costly, and people don't like them. So I think that those are many processes that give one some sense that something's going on that most people, and certainly the press, hasn't been, had been able to cover.
We're speaking with Professor Gar Alperovitz. The name of the book is What Then Must We Do? We need to take a short break, Professor. Before we do, though, I found lots of websites for you. What website or websites should we send our listeners to?
Well, the easiest one is the title of the book strung together, What Then Must We Do? Just put those words together. Another one, just to get examples, which is called community-wealth.org or .com, either way, and that just surveys these kinds of experiments that I talk about in What Then Must We Do. Now, if you can spell my name, I have a website, but it's Gar Alperovitz, strung together, G-A-R-A-L, P as in Peter, E-R-O, V as in Victor, I, T as in Tom, Z, Gar Alperovitz. But you'll find that by going to What Then Must We Do. You'll find my name, and you could go to my personal website as well.
That sounds like the easiest way.
I think
okay.
so.
Okay, one more short break, and it's whatthenmustwedo.org, I found. Okay, one more short break, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station. If you want to avoid costly repairs from clogged pipes, you should avoid dumping cooking grease or oil down your kitchen drain. Instead, pour it into a metal can, let it cool, and throw it away in your regular trash. Remember to can the grease. Call 311 or visit miamidade.gov for more information.
The Truman Legacy Symposium explores the impact of Harry S. Truman's presidency on Friday and Saturday, May 18th and 19th. Speakers include former chair of the House Armed Services Committee, Ike Skelton, Clifton Truman Daniel, and Ken Heckler, a member of Truman's staff, among others. It starts Friday evening, May 18th at the Little White House and concludes Saturday afternoon, May 19th at the Marriott Key West Beachside Hotel. Details at TrumanSymposium.com. Brought to you by the Monroe County Tourist Development Council.
If you're having a hard time selling that old car or truck or just don't want the bother of selling it, the WLRN Vehicle Donation Program can help. Just call 877-WLRN-CAR, 877-957-6227, or donate online at WLRN.org. Donating is easy when the tow truck comes to your home and picks up the vehicle. They give you the paperwork that you'll need and relieve the stress of what to do with the old car that just won't sell. That's 877-WLRN-CAR or donate online at WLRN.org.
The U.S. economy is swooning while the Latin American economy is booming, giving it the clout to challenge decades of U.S. influence. I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Tim Padgett. Join us tonight at 7 for The Sunshine Economy, The Americas and Miami on WLRN, made possible by Kaufman, Rawson & Company.
And it's more Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman, we resume our conversation with Professor Gar Alperovitz of the University of Maryland. Let's take a call or two. Stephen, Pembroke Pines, you're up. Hi.
Hi. Good afternoon, gentlemen. I was in Vietnam. I was drafted. I was on the operation that's depicted in the movie Platoon. I was observing the Vietnamese Viet Cong women who fought in combat alongside the men. And not officially with the NVA, but with the Viet Cong. Anyway, I'm calling up because men's issues is my concern. I was part of the first wave of the men's movement, and people were laughing at us along the way, and these days they're not laughing any longer. We had a brief episode, a Million Man March, back, I believe, in the mid-90s, and then alongside Promise Keepers, the Christian Promise Keepers, who co-opted the men's issues from us. And that's some example of what the professor was talking about, how we see certain instances of going back to his comments regarding the occupation movement. And these things happen, and when they do happen, it causes dramatic, peaceful waves. Also, there are more successive waves with larger numbers of anti-war veterans coming back from the last four or five wars. Post-Korea. And I'd like your comments on that, please.
I think the basic point that listener is pointing to is that we tend to forget that vast social movements happen in history very frequently. And the moment that they hit, they're always unpredicted. Let me give you a good example, and I cover this in my book, and What Then Must We Do. I'm from Wisconsin originally. And I was a young kid when Joe McCarthy, famous really very anti-communist popular kind of mudslinging senator, was there in Wisconsin. He's a Wisconsin senator. And they shot anything that moved politically. People were frightened. And if you had said, you know, that what's going to happen? Well, you said obviously nothing can change politically. That was what it felt like. And of course, the 1960s happened immediately thereafter. So I'm not predicting that it's inevitable that major change will occur. I'm saying that superficial, what you see in the press today may or may not tell you what's going on well below the surface, as nobody had known in the 1950s that we'd have the explosion of the 1960s. There's a lot of pain going on. A lot of people are in very severe difficulties. The elderly are, this generation of the elderly are without significant pensions. The studies are, there's going to be a lot of pain there. Young people are not getting jobs. Many people are beginning to feel the crunch of unemployment or fear of unemployment. And in the face of that, there are these experiments beginning to develop at, you know, that I'm covering in What Then Must We Do, that show that there may be a different way to change who owns the system, the 1% or the 400 people that have more wealth than the bottom 180 million. Or is there a democratic, very American, you know, the choice is not between corporate capitalism and crazy communism. There may be another alternative. Who says that there's only two alternatives? There's a very American thing going on, and I think it really is worth paying attention to as the pain develops. These are, you know, the phrase used to be, the New Deal occurred because of what happened in the state and local laboratories, quote, of democracy. And what then must we do is about that, plus some of the big things going on nationally. We did, after all, in a moment of crisis, people tend to forget, we did nationalize big auto companies because we had to, and then gave them back after the taxpayers subsidized them. That may not happen 20 years from now if this continues.
We have an emailer, Fritz. Would internet-based direct democracy, cutting out sellout elected representatives where the people vote directly on what we want, not be the solution? If such a system were in place, we would have had a nationwide single-payer health care system. Polls always show 70% of voters wanting it.
You know, that I don't have a clear view of that, but what I would say is there's a lot of experimentation with much more direct democracy, and this is one of them in which people actually can, there have been forms of direct, where they bring people together to really get briefed on what's going on locally, and then participatory decision-making is developing in several cities. And it may well be that the internet will play that the role that the emailer suggests. That's another area where experimentation is going on, and I myself am not quite sure how far it'll go.
George wants to know, what's a better solution that you can envision for hurricane and other disaster insurance?
I'm not a specialist in that area, but I do think, you know, public responsibility is clear, and we really need to get on top of this one.
Professor, do you think that young people today are actually progressive?
Well, this is very interesting because, you know, when you talk about co-ops and worker-owned companies and city and state banks like the Bank of North Dakota, the word socialism always pops up, and it used to be a red flag, certainly when I was younger. There has been polling on this data about younger people, which really quite surprised me. There have been three polls by major polling organizations in the last 2 years. They all show that when people are asked, young people under 30 are asked, do you like the word capitalism or socialism, mostly they're pretty indifferent. They see them about the same. But the polling trend now is for slightly more favorable treatment of the word socialism than capitalism by people under 30. So I found that very surprising, but also interesting that the word, even the word socialism, doesn't have the valence and the kind of scary part that it used to have. So you might call a co-op or a public, in a bank like the Bank of North Dakota, socialism, if you like. But people are not sort of scared off by these words, apparently, particularly younger people. And those are the people who are going to build the next system. It's not the older folks. It's going to be, they certainly can help, but the next generation are the ones that are going to feel the pain and are already feeling the real pain of the failing system and are looking for alternatives. So the fact that they're not so scared off by the old scare words is quite interesting.
Professor, just one other question. We are running out of time. What is the Democracy Collaborative? I see you're a co-founder of that.
The Democracy Collaborative is an institution within the University of Maryland that studies and does research on all of these democratic ownership forms, and in some cases tries to help kind of experiments that are advancing more sophisticated forms. We've done some work in Cleveland, but there are many, many cities around the country that are exploring new strategies, and to the extent we have some expertise, and staff, we try to help.
Well,
but our
Professor,
main is research.
We're going to have to go. We certainly want to thank you. We've been speaking with Professor and author Gar Alperovitz of the University of Maryland. His latest work is What Then Must We Do? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Professor.
Thank you very much.
And thanks for tuning in this hour. Our apologies to those callers we couldn't get on the air. Our producer is Richard Ives. Director is Caroline Brader-Watts, with Paul Leary as online producer. Remember, we have free audio archives and downloads at our website. That's WLRN.org. And also links and info at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow we go at your service. We'll address consumer protection issues with experts and, of course, take your calls. Now the calendar. On this day in 1856, 157 years ago, the birth of psychoanalytic originator Sigmund Freud in Moravia. His work encompassed sexual theories, of course. He also dabbled in cocaine. And on this day in 1903, 110 years ago, the birth of famed restaurateur and raconteur Toots Shore in Philadelphia. Once a bar bouncer, his restaurant was New York's hottest celebrity dining and watering hole. He once battled Jackie Gleason in a drinking contest. The great one hit the floor. And one more while we recall the catch in the 1954 World Series. On this day in 1931, 82 years ago, the birth of Hall of Famer Willie Mays in Westfield, Alabama. The New York and San Francisco Giant, the Say Hey Kid finished his career with the Mets. Our theme music, created by Michael Levine. So we leave with the classic line from Yogi Berra. Quote, Toots Shore's restaurant is so crowded, nobody goes there anymore. This is Joseph Cooper. Thanks for making public radio your companion today. Stay tuned now for the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And I also say goodbye to my colleague, Bonnie Burke.
This is 91.3.